listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Whoever conducted the attacks, Russia ultimately bears responsibility for the victims in East Ghouta and countless other Syrians targeted with chemical weapons since Russia became involved in Syria.
That was U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson in Paris on Tuesday, blaming Russia for a recent reported chemical attack in East Ghouta. Tillerson also blamed Syria's President Bashar al-Assad. Secretary Tillerson offered no evidence, however, to support those claims. Meanwhile, at the United Nations, a special meeting called by Russia on the question of chemical weapons in Syria. Russia's permanent representative to the UN in New York, Vasily Nebenzia, had called the meeting, and he was the first to speak.
Thank you, Mr. President. We've requested a convening of an open Security Council meeting due to the fact that the issue which we intend to raise is far too important to hold the discussions in closed consultations. And by the way, we have nothing to hide. When yesterday we discussed Syria during consultations, many touched upon an issue, the issue of the importance of the establishment of a new structure to investigate into instances of chemical weapons use in Syria to supplant what has fully discredited itself, that is the joint UN-OPCW mechanism, the JIM. We have never forgotten about this, and we consistently recalled during meetings about our willingness to continue consultations on this matter. And this is something which Minister Lavrov mentioned to Secretary General of the United Nations last week. However, yesterday, we could not meet that call. We could not rise to that. Today, following instructions from Capitol, it is an honor for me to report the following. Russia consistently underscores the importance of the most serious approach to the matter of production and use of chemical weapons. We are troubled by the emergence of chemical weapons terrorism in the Middle East, which is not limited to Syrian territory. Unfortunately, the gym, which has ceased to exist, has caused the investigation to collapse. The investigation failed. The investigation, which from the scientific technical point of view was a complete failure, and it became a mechanism for political manipulation. With the conduct by Russian specialists of a scrupulous analysis of the outcomes of the gym, members of the international community and of the Security Council were familiar with this. The U.S. delegation attempted to interpret certain elements of Russian approaches. During consultations on 9 January, it circulated the relevant document. However, nor in this document did we see an attempt to approach this matter from a professional standpoint. The so-called repudiation of our position withstands no criticism. I would request that you familiarize yourselves with our response material, which yesterday we circulated as an official Security Council document. Incidentally, today, there were further unfounded allegations against Russia by senior U.S. State Department representatives alleging that Russia is hampering the conduct of international investigations into chemical weapons allegations in Syria. We have already responded to this. Those who wish to do so can read the remarks and familiarize themselves with the comments from Russian Deputy Minister Ryabkov, remarks addressing this issue. Nobody has further requested an investigation from us, a professional investigation rather than an imitation of an investigation into instances of chemical weapons use in Syria. And presently, we continue to seek to ensure that the OPCW have its specialists visit Syria to familiarize themselves with the storage sites of chemical weapons that were discovered by the Syrian government, these storage sites which were left behind by militants in the liberated areas. Incidentally, during yesterday's consultations, following reports about some new instances of the use of chemical warfare agents in Syria, which is yet to be corroborated, the U.S. representative and the U.K. representative, without any shame, prior to advancing any evidence, not to mention an investigation, hastily accused the Syrian, as they call it, regime. Now, they are attempting to drag Russia into this as well. And this is something which Secretary of State Tillerson stated today in Paris during a meeting with the so-called International Voluntary Partnership of States to prevent impunity in chemical weapons use. Building his statement around an incident that allegedly occurred yesterday in eastern Ghouta. And incidentally, his statement was exclusively focused on Russia. Incidentally, does it not seem strange to anybody that this alleged episode, the veracity of which is yet to be confirmed, and where necessary, then perpetrators would be identified, somehow very easily, for some reason, converges with the meeting in Paris and the forthcoming Congress in Sochi, the Syrian National Dialogue Congress in Sochi. Somehow they coincide. This is a strange coincidence. Some states continue to persist in their attempts at any cost to push through an anti-Damascus decision at the OPCW, undermining the authority of this esteemed delegation. Others are attempting to establish a narrow alliance of fighters against impunity by leveraging illegitimate formats. In November last year, Russia, together with like-minded parties, drafted a resolution which would ensure that the joint investigative mechanisms initiatives would be aligned with the high standards of the OPCW, guaranteeing a genuinely impartial and professional investigation. At that point, that initiative was blocked by a number of delegations. We wish to rise above these differences and to propose the establishment of a new international investigative body, which on the basis of irreproachable and corroborated information received from transparent and credible sources would be able to establish evidence for the Security Council to identify perpetrators in the use of chemical weapons or chemical warfare agents. This mechanism needs to be professional, and it must be an apolitical mechanism. We drew up the relevant draft resolution. We request that the Secretariat circulate said draft resolution. We trust that members of the Security Council will shortly consider their initiative and study it with their capitals. We stand ready to engage in substantive consultations. Thank you, Mr. President.
I thank representative of the Russian Federation for his statement, and I give the floor to the representative of the United States.
Ambassador Nikki Haley.
Thank you, Mr. President. Russia has convened us with almost no notice and then put forth a proposal that they hope will distract from a new French initiative to hold accountable those who use chemical weapons. Today, Russia is yet doing what it does best when it comes to chemical weapons. Russia is running from the facts. Russia has the audacity to lecture this Security Council about how to stop the use of chemical weapons. I know I've said this before, but it's worth repeating. In the past year, Russia used its veto three times to kill the Joint Investigative Mechanism in Syria. Russia, all on its own, killed the mechanism we had specifically tasked to identify those responsible for using chemical weapons in Syria. Russia should look in the mirror before bringing us into the Security Council to talk about chemical weapons. Earlier this week, we received yet another report that the Assad regime has used chlorine gas against its own people. Dozens of civilians had to be treated for suffocation. Syrian children were literally gasping for breath as chlorine gas surrounded them. Of course, it's no coincidence that this week's chlorine gas attack reportedly happened in the exact place the Assad regime is trying to take over militarily. We know the Assad regime resorts to these brutal tactics when they want to retake territory without any regard for innocent civilians. And we know that for years, Russia has looked the other way while their Syrian friends use these despicable weapons of war. Russia is complicit in the Assad regime's atrocities. Will the Russian Federation say anything at all today about the suffering caused by Assad's barbaric tactics? Will they hold Assad to account? Of course not. They never do. So it's fitting Russia brought us here the same day that a new initiative on chemical weapons accountability was introduced in Paris. Today, France launched the International Partnership Against Impunity for Chemical Weapons. We strongly support this effort, and we commend France for their leadership. More than 25 like-minded countries have come together to share information on who used chemical weapons and to preserve that information to make sure that perpetrators will be held accountable. Make no mistake, the United States will continue to pursue, along with this council, those who have used chemical weapons to ensure that they are held accountable for their atrocities. Russia says they have concerns with this French initiative to share evidence of chemical weapons use. That is no surprise. Russia opposed the Joint Investigative Mechanism because it collected facts about who used chemical weapons in Syria. Now, Russia questions this French effort to collect facts on who used chemical weapons. What can we conclude? Simply put, when Russia doesn't like the facts, they try and distract the conversation. That's because the facts come back over and over again to the truth Russia wants to hide, that the Assad regime continues to use chemical weapons against its own people. Once again, Russia today threw around lots of different accusations. Again, that's not surprising. Russia often puts out misleading and unfounded claims to confuse the conversation about chemical weapons. In fact, this happens so often that we recently wrote to the Security Council with a detailed assessment of Russia's misleading claims. The letter is public and available for anyone to see. We encourage everyone to take a look at it for yourselves. Here's the bottom line. The Security Council gave the Joint Investigative Mechanism a mandate to tell us who used chemical weapons in Syria. When investigators found ISIS to be responsible, Russia was fine. When the investigators found that the Assad regime used them, Russia tried to find any excuse to poke holes in the investigation and threw up smoke to question the findings. But that is not how independent investigations work. You don't get to question the findings when they don't go your way. So we're not going to accept any Russian proposal that undermines our ability to get to the truth or that politicizes what must be an independent and impartial investigation. If they want to work in good faith toward that goal, we are ready to reestablish the GIM with its original independent and impartial mandate right now. But anything less is unacceptable. To be crystal clear, the United States supports accountability for anyone who uses chemical weapons. We agree with Russia that ISIS must be held accountable for their use of these weapons, as the Joint Investigative Mechanism has found. But the difference between the United States and Russia is that we believe no one should be let off the hook. Chemical weapons must never be used. So Russia can continue to talk for as long as they want about chemical weapons. They can bring this up in the Security Council chamber as often as they want. We welcome the debate. The United States and the international community are not going to be fooled. We remain steadfast in pursuing accountability for those who use chemical weapons. We stand strong in doing all that we can to preserve the norm against their use. And we remain forever committed to preserving the truth of what the Assad regime has done in Syria and, sadly, what they will likely continue to do. Thank you.
I thank Representative of the United States for her statement. I give the floor to the Representative of France.
As you've already heard from both the Russian and American ambassadors, France hosted a gathering Tuesday on the question of chemical weapons in Syria.
Mr. President, we have gathered here today in the wake of reports pointing to another chemical weapons attack in Syria in the city of Douma, which claimed more than 20 victims, including women and children. And furthermore, this was an attack in an area located within an a de-escalation zone. We are closely following all of the available information and anticipate that the International Operational Investigation Mechanism, above all the fact-finding mission, will shed light on the circumstances around such an attack. As we this year mark the 100th anniversary of the end of the First World War, during which for the first time in the history of humanity, chemical weapons were used, produced in industrial at the industrial scale, with the persistence of such crimes in Syria violates international conscience as well as the most fundamental human rights. The facts that have been averred reflect that this scourge continues to rage. Last year, for April in Syria, more than 80 people, including women and children, died after having been struck by a powerful neurotoxin. 4 years prior, in 2013, 2,000 Syrian civilians were literally gassed in Ghouta, with sarin gas being used. This use of chemical weapons was confirmed by the OPCW. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the responsibility of the Syrian regime and Daesh was clearly established by the joint investigative mechanism of the OPCW and the United Nations. France, for its part, independently corroborated the responsibility of the Syrian regime for the 4 April attack. Since 2013, investigations has shown that there have been more than 100 allegations of chemical weapons use, largely in Syria, but also in Iraq and in Malaysia. Chlorine, sarin, mustard, VX, these names of death have been brought to the front line once again on the international stage. And with them, the horrific images of victims of these weapons of terror, which remain etched in our minds, have been brought to the fore. We cannot allow this to stand. Such weapons destabilize the entire regime. They undermine the security and safety of all of us all. They heighten the risk of terror, of chemical terrorism, which we all fear. They also undermine the chemical weapons prohibition regime and all non-proliferation regimes. They erode the responsibility of the international community and erode all of our efforts. Hence, it is our duty to act. It is a responsibility which we shoulder in the face of history. And dear friends, together we must act on this responsibility. This must be on the conscience of all of us who state our commitment to the non-proliferation regime, which we continue to build upon. Let us be clear. Those who hamper our efforts to combat impunity de facto establish impunity for perpetrators of chemical weapons attacks. They prevent us from prosecuting those who participate in scientific programs, governments, and entities who order such actions to be carried out and deter them from continuing. And hence, we cannot turn our eyes. The non-proliferation regime for chemical weapons today is the most developed regime of all international non-proliferation regimes, allowing it to scatter about without acting would mean that the whole non-proliferation regime for WMDs would be undermined. This is a regime which, stone by stone, we built together over the course of decades. And today, this constitutes the very backbone of the international security architecture. And it stands as one of the main gains of multilateralism. For this reason, France has proposed the establishment of a new international partnership to combat impunity in the use of chemical weapons or the use by whomsoever, be they state actors, be they non-state actors. This partnership was launched yesterday in Paris during a conference convened by the French Foreign Minister, Mr. Jean-Yves Le Drian. 24 states responded. They attended and reaffirmed their willingness to act together to counter this threat. This is a thrust of the ambitious commitments we have undertaken under this partnership. Inter alia, I would note, and this is not an exhaustive list, the transmission and exchange of information about perpetrators of attacks each time this is possible, a commitment to impose national or international sanctions against concerned entities or individuals, assistance for capacity building of voluntary states for designation and for sanctions, the issuance of a single consolidated list with names of individuals implicated in these attacks, the criminals who have assumed responsibility to use and design these barbaric weapons must understand that there will be no impunity. At stake is the future of the whole of our collective security system. We cannot allow these fundamental standards to be breached without consequences being brought forth. Due to some obstructions, we were unable to renew the mandate of the GIM late last year. Consultations on Syria yesterday confirmed the fact that a broad majority, an overwhelming majority of the Council cannot accept this standstill. In this context, we have taken note of Russia's proposal today. We will consider this proposal in the light of the principles which I've just recalled. The new partnership set up in partnership is not geared towards supplanting international mechanisms or investigative mechanisms established by the UN or the OPCW. On the contrary, it is intended to supplement and to support this machinery by making available for the multilateral system and the international community a new operational tool. This will help to conduct investigations and will assist the international judiciary in conducting its work. This is neither an anti-Syrian instrument, nor a small restricted club of countries. All states who wish to do so can join this partnership by subscribing to the statement of principles which underpins it. Through this commitment, they will demonstrate their commitment to law, international stability, justice, and security. And these will enable us to put an end to impunity for perpetrators and accomplices in chemical weapons attacks. Through this partnership, we hence are acting to shore up the chemical weapons prohibition regime. a partnership, the first stone of which was laid down in Paris, and it embodies our faith in effective multilateralism. In order to act without delay, I confirm that France has adopted a series of assets freezes for networks implicated in the use of chemical weapons in Syria. I would lastly recall the fact that there can be no justice, no lasting peace in Syria without an end being put to impunity. How can we continue to uphold the regime, to reaffirm its willingness to speak in good faith and seek a political solution when that very same regime uses barbaric weapons against its own population? The gap has never been this great between words and actions. I stated this, and I will restate this in Vienna and Geneva. Within the UN framework, we must act together for a political solution in Syria. Full implementation of an inclusive political solution set forth under Resolution 2254, which more than ever before is our common guide, hinges on the establishment of a neutral environment in Syria. And this can be guaranteed and guarantee a clear commitments of the regime for credible constitutional change and free elections. This is the only way to put a lasting end to the suffering endured in Syria. We continue to believe that it is necessary, it is possible to bring together the Security Council to attain that end. Thank you.
I give the floor to the representative of China.
Mr. President, China expresses a grave concern over the use of chemicals as weapons in Syria and extends our deep sympathy to the Syrian people for their suffering. China's position on chemical weapons has been clear and consistent. We firmly oppose the use of chemical weapons by any country, organization, or individual for any purpose and under any circumstances. The no acts of using chemical weapons any whenever or wherever can be tolerated. China supports a comprehensive, objective, and fair investigation into the related incidents to arrive at a conclusion that can test can stand the test of history and facts and bring the perpetrators to justice on that basis. On the basis of that, China welcomes the draft resolution distributed by Russia on establishing a new investigation mechanism on Syrian chemical weapons and appreciates the efforts made by Russia in the Council to continue to push forward work on Syrian chemical weapons issue. China will seriously study the draft and actively participate in the consultation on the draft resolution. It is imperative to establish a new investigation mechanism to find out the truth and deter further use of chemical weapons in Syria. We hope the Council members can participate in the consultation in a constructive manner and strive to reach a consensus on the establishment of a new mechanism. The Syrian chemical weapon issue is closely linked to the political settlement of a Syrian issue and requires a comprehensive, balanced, and integrated approach. China supports the role of the Security Council and OPCW as the main channel for the appropriate resolution of a Syrian chemical weapons issue. We hope that all the relevant parties will take a constructive attitude to seek appropriate solutions through consultations. We must maintain the unity of the Council and coordinate with the relevant parties in the effort to actively promote the political process in Syria. Thank you, Mr. President.
The representative of the Russian Federation has asked for the floor to make a further statement. I give him the floor.
Thank you, Mr. President. It is unfortunate that my friend Nikki Haley has left the hall. I wish to note that she mentioned that we arrived here at the first call, at our first call, for which I apologized. But we repeatedly came here at the first call of Nikki Haley, and we stand ready to continue to do so. And please tell her that I'm doing this because I'm always very pleased to see her. Today, once again, everything that we heard from the United States in their statement was about Russia. What is immediately repudiated in our resolution speaks about a great deal. Once again, it shows a truth which we unfortunately know, the United States does not need any independent professional mechanism. Not only are you betraying the truth, but you are also betraying yourselves in the face of the international community. And I will be frank, I mentioned this in the format of a rhetorical question. The supposition, the allegations about which have not yet been confirmed, they remain allegations about chemical weapons use in eastern Ghouta, did not accidentally emerge on the eve of important political events in Syria, the meeting in Vienna and the Syrian National Dialogue Congress in Sochi. Furthermore, once again, I reiterate, why do you need an investigative mechanism when even yesterday and today, prior to any investigation being conducted, you are alleging without any doubts that this is something which was done by the Syrian government, so you are both judge and accuser? Do you understand that you are betraying yourselves this way? Just through that, if you genuinely wish to establish a professional, independent mechanism, a professionally attributative mechanism, then at least familiarize yourselves with the draft resolution prior to repudiating said draft resolution. Did we not discuss a new mechanism with members of the council when there was a conclusion of a multi-act political mechanism for the conclusion of the GYM? This was a spectacle, a multi-act political spectacle that took place, which culminated in the shutdown of the GYM. We did not have this event with any partners, but I do wish to reiterate what I already mentioned at a meeting on 18 January at the Council under the presidency of President Nazarbayev. There are no commissions, partnerships, or so-called independent mechanisms in that realm. No such bodies will be legitimate unless they are approved by the Security Council. And this is a premise from which we must proceed. I would repeat what the permanent representative of Sweden mentioned in the statement. And not only he mentioned this. We need to surmount our differences. We need to delve into dialogue. And we need to attempt to reunite the council, the council's unity that had been eroded. This must be rebuilt. And this is the thrust of our proposal. Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Days ago, the U.S. Secretary of Defense James Mattis updated and revised America's global defense strategy. It is a dark vision of the world and calls for massive defense spending. What he calls a defense strategy, critics say, is a blueprint for wars without end. Crosstalking Endless Wars, I'm joined by my guest, Michael Vlahos in Washington. He is a professor of strategy at the Johns Hopkins University. Also in Washington, we have Christopher Nyewaim. He is a former Army police sergeant, Iraq War veteran, and contributor to the Hill newspaper. And in Purcellville, we cross to Philip Giraldi. He is a former CIA counterterrorism specialist who is now executive director of the Council for the National Interest. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Philip, let me go to you first in Purcellville. I read the report, and I will repeat what I said in my introduction. I found it to be a rather dark vision of the world. It was less about defense strategy than preserving or advancing hegemony around the world. And I found it remarkably lacking in any kind of discussion of international law. Go ahead, Philip.
Well, yes. I mean, international law did not enter into it. It is not as it describes itself, a defense strategy. It's an offense strategy. And essentially, what it does, it takes away any genuine threats against the United States and against the American people, like ISIS, and it shifts the defense burden onto being competitive with other countries in the world, most specifically Russia and China. And essentially, it creates a case, if you want to call it that, for spending vast amounts of more money on defense, basically to promote American interests, which have nothing whatsoever to do with defending the country.
Okay, that was my reading as well. Michael, weigh in on that, okay? Of course, I think we would all agree that the United States has an adversarial relationship with Russia and China. I can accept that. They all have their own national interests, and they will pursue them. However, the way shifting away from terrorism, taking away even talk of the climate, I got this feeling reading the report, we're going back into the 19th century of great power struggles here. The difference is these powers have nuclear weapons. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, this is primarily an exercise in strategic rhetoric. And as such, it lays out a kind of highly aggressive ceremonial strategy, what you might call a fierce face strategy. And that is simply because the U.S. has entered a historical period where its leadership is declining and will eventually find itself, say, like Spain did in the early 17th century, in a position where it can no longer orchestrate the kind of hegemonic status that it had come to define itself on. And so my sense is the U.S. is staking out highly aggressive histrionics and theater in order to maintain others' fear and in order to cloak the increasing insecurity that we feel. Because as you said, Peter, although we're pursuing a kind of endless war strategy, as Spain found out in the 17th century, endless war feeds on itself. And at the very end of that, you're kind of used up. And that's where we are now. We're entering into a kind of twilight period that may last as long as it did for Spain, as long as 40 years before we finally give up and say, well, we can't do this anymore.
Okay, Christopher, let me read some of the words from James Mattis when he was introducing the report here. But I found quite bewildering here. To those who threaten America's experiment in democracy, if you challenge us, it will be your longest and worst day. So what does this have to do with national security? I mean, who is attacking America's democracy other than the Democratic Party cheating Bernie Sanders and possibly the DOJ trying to undermine a legally elected president of the United States? I find it really quite galling that the defense secretary is talking about democracy when one can make the supposition right, that it's very challenged in the U.S. itself. Go ahead, Christopher.
Sure. I think that, Secretary Mattis is a Marine. He understands war. I understand war. And I think that taking this position, he's asserting himself. He's establishing a tenor on the global stage. And we're just sort of stating the obvious that these are global powers on the end of a long history. I mean, post-World War II, the main power players have in some ways stayed the same, but the U.S. role has expanded. I actually look at this a little bit differently in reverse.
Sure.
I think we want to, the U.S. is focusing on nuclear deterrence, and the idea of this strategy is focused back on deterring nuclear powers, namely North Korea, from continuing to be aggressive while reducing endless war. I think Russia and the United States has both seen the experience of endless combat with forces that are sort of enigmatic, things like ISIS. You know, we there's ways to control those without having those endless conflicts. So it's a recalibration focused on principled security networks in Asia and preventing those kinds of conflicts. And yes, China and Russia are powerful nation states. They're sovereign. And those were the traditional, sort of power players. And so we're just focused on the basics.
Okay. Philip, can I read to you some more words from the secretary? Quote, we will develop enduring coalitions to consolidate gains we have made. Gains. I repeat, gains we've made in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, and elsewhere to support the lasting defeat of terrorists as we sever their sources of strength and counterbalance Iran. I mean, gains, I don't know what he's talking about whatsoever. The candidate Trump said that he didn't want to go down the path of nation building. Well, the United States now is involved in nation building in part of Syria, okay? That path is being continued here. I can't see any gains in the countries that I just mentioned. I don't know what he's talking about, Philip.
Yeah, well, I don't either. I think that he's completely delusional. There's another comment in the report or by Mattis where it's in the report, basically says there's a confusion by the Russians, Chinese, and Iranians between civic issues and military issues. Now, what country in the world has confused civic and military issues more than the United States? So I really don't get this. I think that there certainly have been no gains, nothing but disasters in those countries that he cited. And there's other stuff in this report. I'm sorry, it's not a conventional laying out of American strategy moving forward. This is more so a ticket for mischief on the part of the administration. And there's if we go to the issue of nuclear weapons, obviously. Right. Nuclear weapons should be a major issue. And there's a comment in here that basically says that in the report that the United States, when confronted with issues of national importance, like the standard of living of Americans, will be able to use nuclear weapons in a first strike capacity. And this is quite incredible stuff.
And that's again, and that includes countries that do not have those kinds of weapons, I would like to point out as well. Okay, you know, Michael, you know, I'm really kind of confused here, is that, and I want to ask the same question of Christopher, is this Donald Trump's foreign policy? Because it's stark contrast to what he ran on, okay? Everything that's going on right now from Yemen to Syria, Iran is being targeted here. I mean, it seems to be such a continuation. It doesn't seem to matter who's the president of the United States. It's the deep state that decides who our enemies are and how they will be dealt with, okay? Because the contrast is so great that I've never seen it from a candidate to a president in my lifetime. Go ahead, Michael.
Well, candidates get captured when they move from the campaign and from their own voice, however authentic or inauthentic it is, and then they get subsumed into the imperial worldview of the imperial city. And the courtiers, or the deep state, if you want to call it that instead, reshape their worldview. And in many ways, the overarching sensibility in Washington today in terms of strategy is one of tremendous anxiety and insecurity.
Yeah, yeah.
And so a grandstanding strategy that looks like it's doing things, that looks aggressive, like the war on ISIS, it's all a wonderful kind of demonstration and display. The U.S. is not going to risk a big war with either China or Russia, but it will grandstand. Hence the 10,000 or so Barrett 50 caliber sniper rifles to Ukraine.
Yeah.
That is grandstanding. The same with Rocket Man and North Korea. It's a way of the U.S. Boasting forcefully, but what I would bring home, I think, is the contrast between forceful boasting of Trump and the very much more successful forceful boasting of Teddy Roosevelt. And the difference is that Teddy Roosevelt was announcing America's debut on the world stage, and America had 40% of the world's manufacturing. Today, it's absolutely the opposite in terms of trends and direction.
Okay, let me go to Christopher. Christopher, you're an Iraq war veteran. I mean, if I could just ask you personally, I mean, it seems like we have a continuation of this mentality of empire. For Iraq, it's been a disaster. For Afghanistan, it's always a disaster. And what's happening in Syria here? But we don't seem to learn any lessons here. You were there. Do you see what the problem is here?
Right. I think there's a few different issues. I want to try to address as many as I can. I think that we're omitting several different things here. We're overlooking several different things. For one, I think the president's actually moving away from nation building. We're trying to get, for example, the Iraqi security forces and the Iraqi military has had significant gains against ISIS. We've been trying to empower them to take the reins and to be able to do that kind of fighting themselves. We've also omitted the fact that we've decimated the leadership of ISIS. We've kept them in a constant state of confusion. We've killed Osama bin Laden. There are several strategic strategic victories that have occurred along the way. We also forgetting the U.S. military provides significant foreign aid to our allies. We still provide a blanket of security across Europe. We're protecting South Korea. We've been in a global leadership role for decades, and those are the kinds of issues we're focused on. There's no one trying to escape the United States the way they're trying to escape North Korea.
Let me jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Washington's new defense strategy. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Philip in Percival. And right before we went to the break, Christopher was talking about our alliances. Well, you know, alliances are a transmission belt for war. We've seen this historically. And I'm thinking of the situation that the United States is facing with its NATO ally, Turkey. And Turkey's illegally invaded Syria. And we know all of the entanglements that the U.S. has found itself there with the Kurds and whatnot, and its NATO ally here. I mean, and then we had, not too long ago, we had a Russian jet that was shot down by the Turks. Then you have, you have this Article 5 kick in here. It seems to me the United States is very dangerously involved in a potential war that it doesn't want to fight. And then we can bring up the issue of North and South Korea. You know what? They're talking. That's a good start, isn't it? And then we have this bluster coming out of Washington that maybe it's not enough. I mean, the South Koreans probably know best about their defense than anyone else. Go ahead, Philip.
Yeah, well, I have to agree with your premise, which is essentially that America's alliances have, in many ways, outlived their usefulness. Russia does not threaten the United States, does not really threaten Eastern Europe. It has a sphere of influence like every other country, but this does not amount to a threat. And NATO is dangerous in a way because NATO could very much involve the United States in a shooting war where it doesn't want to be in it. And I would comment on the situation between Turkey and Syria. Turkey is indeed attacking Syria, but Turkey has an interest in Syria. The PKK terrorism problem and the Kurdish problem for Turks is very real. Sure. The United States is illegally in Syria, so the United States shouldn't be throwing stones at anyone when it comes to the situation currently in Syria. And this whole concept of a 30,000 man border guard is just totally ridiculous. The Turks won't let it happen. The Syrians won't let it happen, and the Iraqis won't even let it happen.
Okay, you know, Michael, you mentioned Ukraine earlier here. I mean, explain, because I don't understand it. What is in the national interest of the United States of America to be giving offensive weapons to Ukraine when we know, and our viewers that have been watching Crosstalk over the years know the importance of the Minsk Accord? Okay, it's not perfect, but it certainly slowed things down, cooled things down. Now we have legislation that is not reported in Western media that the Ukrainians have walked away from it unilaterally, and now they're very happily taking offensive arms. We have to be honest here. The prospect of a Ukrainian-Russian war is very real, folks. It's very real. But you wouldn't know that, and you wouldn't know that by reading Mattis's report. Go ahead, Michael.
The U.S. Finds that its alliances, both NATO and its key alliances in East Asia and the Western Pacific, are like lifelines to America's claim to hegemony. So it is to American advantage to stir the pot in Eastern Europe and to create a situation where, you know, poor, helpless Ukraine is being threatened with deep violence by, and this is an old metaphor going back to World War I, frankly, and the Germans in Belgium. And it's a way for the U.S. to maintain the saliency of its position in Europe, which it no longer has economically, and in the instance of good relations with Russia, would not exist in the strategic sense. But because European states, especially Germany, are unwilling to spend the money they need to on defense to do it themselves, which they could easily, then the U.S. By creating, yes, I mean, the Germans could simply double their defense budget and it would be no larger a percentage of their GNP than it was during the Cold War. But the key here is that the U.S. is able to have it both ways. It's able to assemble a kind of crisis in which the U.S. is the absolutely essential partner and its leadership is unquestioned. And frankly, it can do that because of the general disinterest by Germany in stepping up to taking over the leadership role in Europe when it comes to strategic issues. The U.S. is doing the same thing in Asia with Japan. And Japan is willing to be there as the sidekick of the U.S. under all circumstances. And therefore, the U.S. is playing the same game, using the fruits of its absolute victory over Germany and Japan in World War II to continue what will increasingly be the fiction of U.S. world power in the future. Not tomorrow, but 15 okay. years from now.
Okay, Christopher, Michael brings up a very good point. I mean, if you look at the GDP of the European Union, is vast, okay? It equals the United States. Japan certainly isn't a poor country by any standard. South Korea, is, for its size and population, is remarkably successful and very rich, by the way. Why can't they just carry their load for their own security interests? Because what does the U.S. get out of it? I mean, if something happens to the U.S., you think everyone's going to come to the U.S.'s aid from Europe and South Korea and Japan? I don't think so. Why would they? Go ahead.
I think that's a great point. I mean, I think President Trump has challenged NATO and Europe to put more financial resources into their own defense, and I think that would be a thing that we should be supporting. But I want to go back a step. I think we're still continuing to omit many, many different factors. For example, you know, we've sort of discussed the U.S. in this sort of dystopian light and the tone and this vision. People want to come to the United States. People are risking their lives to try and they're dying trying to get out of places like North Korea, where their governments and the way they behave is absolutely zero freedom, no freedom of the press, extremely dystopian. And in the case of Iran, you have an entire government that's stacked with clergy that's frankly extremely dystopian.
But excuse me, Christopher, but I mean, if I could interrupt you for a second, you know, but that has nothing to do with the defense of the United States. You're talking about values, and I suppose that's all fine, but it has nothing to do about protecting the sovereign country of the United States. The State Department should deal with these other issues here. Okay, I mean, I'm serious. I mean, it sounds nice, but it has nothing to do with defense here. Let me go to Philip here. You know, Philip, I was doing a little bit of research before this program. You know, I was looking at, you know, Republican Senator Robert Taft when NATO was started, and he was saying, you know, why should we get involved in this alliance? Because then we lose the right to declare war. We're giving it over to an organization. Then you had Mike Mansfield, and in the 1970s. Under the Nixon and Ford administrations, he was heavily lobbying for ending American presence in Europe because the war has been over. They're rich. They can take care of themselves. The reason why I'm bringing up this boring history for everyone is that where is the debate in the public, in the media, about what is being said in Mattis's report? There's almost none. I mean, I read a lot of the reviews. It's just, well, this is what he said. But there's no distilling of what he's talking about. It just passes it on as if these people are just stenographers in the media and don't question anything that is being written. We're questioning it honestly on this program. Go ahead, Philip.
Yeah, it's quite astonishing. I mean, the stories on this paper and on the comments by Mattis disappeared within 48 hours and were hardly covered at all. And yet this is, as I said in the beginning, this is a formula for offense. This is a formula for the United States to exercise its leadership by military offensive. And this is quite outrageous. And also the question
in what
of,
way? We haven't done anything
weapons
offensive
against states that don't have them.
Christopher, you wanted to jump in there? Go ahead.
Sorry?
You let Christopher jump in.
Well,
go ahead.
Where's Philip, where's Russia on North Korea missile testing and North Korea threatening Hawaii and making these aggressive stances? Does Russia support North Korea's continued nuclear proliferation and launching missiles?
I can answer that question very clearly, Christopher. If you had watched the proceedings at the United Nations Security Council when there was a vote against North Korea in which China and Russia did participate and did vote for the sanction, they also offered an alternative. A freeze for a freeze. And to go back, you can watch it. It's on YouTube. It's very thoughtful. It's very thorough. But you had all of the other countries saying, North Korea bad. Okay, well, I'm sorry, that's not very intellectual, and it's not very helpful, okay? So I would answer you, Christopher, that Russia and China have been extremely helpful in trying to diffuse those tensions. But it doesn't get any coverage in the media, because that's not what people want to hear. Go ahead, Christopher.
No, well, it should be covered. I mean, that's a fair point. There should be more coverage. But when you look at these oil transfers, China's in a position to really do a lot more. I think there's a lot of opportunity and a lot of optimism
to get some of those
things to restrict. Well,
Christopher, why doesn't the United States sit down with the North Koreans and have a conversation? What's so hard about doing that? You could actually say, we went the extra mile. Instead of this rocket man nonsense, that's not helpful, okay? If the United States really wants to show it's responsible in the world, wasn't it sit down and talk seriously? And if it doesn't like the deal, walk away from it. But at least you talked. Go ahead. I'm just saying the obvious.
That's
here.
A fair point. That's a fair point. But I think we have a president that wants to see some results. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of our goodwill and a lot of our diplomacy has had diminishing returns. When you look at, for example, the Iran deal and other things where we're able to get a little bit of cooperation. But what we have is continued nuclear proliferation, continued talk of aggression. And the U.S. is continuing to provide foreign aid, to continue to fund our allies in Europe and these sorts of other things. So I think those talks should happen, and I believe the U.S. is opening to talk to North Korea, but we need to see a sort of tone and tenor of cooperation, and we're continuing to see boasting of continued nuclear proliferation in the region. And remember, the defense security strategy, that's our document for us. There's nothing in there that is overtly offensive. It is a document that is reaffirming our perspective on building up the military, recalibrating relationships.
But you're right, Christopher. It's written about the United States for the United States, but the whole world is watching, and the reaction from a lot of capitals is this is a very aggressive and a continuation of an aggressive foreign policy. The world does react to the most powerful country in the world. All right, gentlemen, I'm sorry we've run out of time. Many thanks to my guests in Washington and in Percival, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.